I'm going to be giving one of the seminars at the Northwest Weekend, and I thought it's a timely topic around this Christmas season to talk about, and so I offered up a topic to Mr. Dick, and he says that would be good. And so I decided, why don't I give it here as a sermon, since I know many here are not able to attend the Northwest Weekend. So I'll be speaking about that today, and kind of, I had more information than I really am going to have time to cover in a 40-minute lecture. So I kind of threw it all into the big melting pot here, and based on how the sermon goes, I'll extract parts of it and use for the presentation for Northwest Weekend. So we are here in the midst of December. It means we're surrounded by Christmas. It's all around us. If you are in school, you can't escape it. It's everywhere. Maybe at the job you have, it rarely comes up. I've worked at places that if people have celebrated Christmas, you wouldn't know it. And I've also worked at places where you can't miss it. It's everywhere. The lights, the shopping, the advertising, music, movies, we're just inundated by programming that fills every space at every time. And then there are those well-wishers that you come across from time to time, wishing you a Merry Christmas. When you hear those words, do you think to yourself, you know, I'm going to tell them that not everybody celebrates this holiday, and I, for one, am one of those people. Or do you think, they don't want to hear that, and if I told them I don't celebrate Christmas, all it's going to be is awkward, and it's not going to do any good anyway, so what's the point of even bringing it up? Recently, we were at a function at the college where I work, and it was a function of my daughter had a recital there, and a friend of hers had, at the very end, wished us a happy season. And the first thing that goes to my mind is, this is fall, but she probably was meaning winter. So happy winter. I mean, that's the first thing that crossed my mind. And later I started thinking, of course, she could have been thinking holiday, but then I thought, well, maybe my daughter shares her beliefs with her friends. So I didn't quite know what she meant, but I thought, you know, I wasn't offended by somebody saying happy season. But I've talked to people in the church over the years, and sometimes it's interesting the reactions you get. Some people say, I don't really think about it, I don't care. Other people said, oh, I hate this time of year. Every time somebody tells me Merry Christmas, I just feel like, you know, keep it to yourself. You know, I started thinking, I wonder how Mr. Luker would deal with it. Because one of the things he used to do at camp all the time is when you would see him, he would always thank you for the service you provided. And I thought, I wonder if he did that. You know, just thank you for your service. Because they're waiting on you at a restaurant, or they're waiting on you at a store. But our attitudes toward this time of year can be varied, because we do feel surrounded by this holiday. It is not something we keep, and sometimes we can stand out like a sore thumb. Christmas has captured the imagination of the world that oftentimes only gives lip service to worship of God. For some people, it's just a big party. That's all they treat it as. A chance to get together, maybe get together with family, get together with friends. And I know there are people out there that are very sincere about their belief around this holiday. They think that they are actually pleasing God and trying to become a better person and trying to make the world a better place. But you know, man is taking care to make sure that this dark time of the year is as bright as possible. I mean, here it is, the shortest time of the year. The days are, I go to work and it's dark. I get off work all the times it's dark. And you think, what a dark time of the year to have a celebration. And so what has man done? He's put up lights everywhere. He's trying to make it as festive an atmosphere as possible, bright colors, lots of music, lots of joyous merriment. People generally are more happy at this time of the year, most people that you run across, than they are at different times of the year. And so the question we got to ask ourselves is, how do we witness during this time of year? The title today is, how do we become a light to a world awash in Christmas lights? Because if we are a light in a world that is blinded by these Christmas lights, do they even see our light? Does it matter? Is this the time of year we really want to witness anyway? I mean, if you're talking about a tough sell, it's kind of hard to have a harder sell than, hey, I have an idea. Everything that you've been planning on for the last few months and everything that's in your mind and heart and hope that you've got for this holiday season, why don't you just throw all that away? I mean, you might get in that conversation with somebody who talks about how expensive it is. I've talked to guys all the time and said, oh, I would love to find a way to go through this holiday without spending any money. And I've heard that from a number of people. Over the years in the church, I've talked to so many people about their thoughts and attitudes for this time of the year. Are you one of these people that disengage? Kind of like when Halloween comes up, we shut off the front porch light, kind of retreat into the house, and we don't come out till morning. No sense driving around on Halloween evening. Don't want any part of that. Do you do that for the whole season? I've known people that do. I don't go to restaurants. I don't go to stores. I just wait for the whole thing to be over. And if you do get out, how are you able to keep a positive attitude toward everything is contrary to what we teach and what we believe? You know, we've been called out of this world for a purpose. And all of us know the scripture, Matthew 24:14, that says, in this gospel, the kingdom will be preached to all the world as a witness, and then the end shall come. We feel like we have this responsibility to get the word out and to tell why we're different. And this is one of those times of year that everybody knows we're different. You know, we don't participate in the office Christmas parties. They want to do their secret Santas. They want to decorate. They want to put up pictures about the holiday and all that. You see the Facebook pages of people that just erupt in this holiday, and we stand out. And so people know that we're different. How do you deal with that? Have you had the experience of the wonderful opportunity to share your beliefs with family members? And I'm sure all of us have, one part or the other. Why do you do what you do? And if your experience is anything like mine and that of my parents, you're speaking to a wall. You try to tell, my parents went through the whole work with their family trying to explain to them how the holidays really worked and what God really wanted from people as far as worship goes. And yeah, it was like speaking to a wall. And this is the one topic that a lot of people want no opposition to. They do not want somebody trying to take away their Christmas. There's a war on Christmas in the world today of the secularists who doesn't want anything to do with religion. And so you have those that want to preserve the traditions, and they talk about, well, we need to change it to do this so that everybody can be happy. So when you come up and say, I just don't want to participate. I want to just go around me. Just pretend I'm not here. Sometimes they see that as a threat to their way of life and their traditions. You know, where I work, somebody put up a whole bunch of Christmas lights around the cubicles. And they were hanging down, and you had to duck under some of them and all that. And at one point somebody said, you know, this is getting to be too much. This is ridiculous how much there is around here. And one of the guys looked at me and said, well, I'm doing my part to bring back the sun, but Jeff's not. You know, he's making light of the pagan customs, and he knew that why I don't keep certain days, and he was making fun of it. The truth is, you could tell people the origin of the holy days, and you could have the history books, you could have the encyclopedias, you can say whatever you want about the origins of this day and how these traditions were being celebrated for thousands of years before Christ ever walked the earth. And the truth is, they don't care. They just don't care. You know, nobody said, what do you mean, bring back the sun? Everybody knew what he was talking about. And nobody cared. And they thought it was funny. You know, over the years, it used to be that ignorance toward the origins of Christmas were everywhere. People didn't know. I actually worked with a guy when he asked me about it, and I told him, no, there's nothing in the Bible about Christmas. He was actually surprised. And that was interesting to me because that was one of those conversations I didn't think I'd have anymore. I mean, once upon a time, you would think that people knew or believed that celebrations of Christmas were in the Bible and that it was something that was just always done from the time of the beginning. But to have somebody out there say, I just assumed it was. He never looked himself and just sort of assumed that the Bible talks about Christmas when it doesn't. But over the years, people have just accepted the fact that whatever we do is fine. We live in a world where everything goes. You don't judge anybody for almost anything. And I work at a place where the more different you are, to a point, the differences that I bring to the table are generally aren't necessarily appreciated where I work. But just about every other type of difference you can think of are widely celebrated. And so nobody cares that all of these things have been mixed together and good and bad and all these things. And whether or not Christ was or wasn't born at this time of year, they just don't care. To them, it's what they do. Whether they buy a gift or not buy a gift or go to a party or not go to a party, it's what people do and it's fun. And when you take a principled stand, they think, what a weirdo. That's generally what they think. Unless they're close to you, and then they might be more sincere and say, you know, I don't know why they feel so strongly about it. I certainly don't feel strongly about it. So they keep Christmas, and you obviously don't because you feel strongly about it. And they might have some sympathy for you and still want to talk to you, even though everyone treats you kind of different. Everyone here has a different experience when it comes to this holiday. My parents came into the church when I was between 8 and 10 years old. It was sort of the transition of us coming into the church. And before that time, we celebrated Christmas. And I have many memories of getting up in the morning and going out to the tree, seeing the pile of presents. And I know what everybody sees in the holiday. I have memories of it. Some people here have never, ever experienced it and might, in the back of their mind, wonder, what am I missing out on? If it was awful, if Christmas was like a root canal, nobody would do it. But it is not an awful experience for these people to go through. They enjoy it. So how do you approach this subject? Your coworkers or classmates might ask, why don't you keep Christmas? But oftentimes, what they're really saying is, what's wrong with you that you don't keep Christmas? What defect do you have? In these situations, it's very easy to get defensive and blurt out some incoherent message about it's all pagan and storm off. And now you've just confirmed in their minds that, yeah, you're a nut. But, you know, before we even talk about how to engage people this time of year, you have to, first of all, see life from their point of view. If we don't see why they appreciate this time of year, what the pull that this world has, how on earth are we ever able to share what we know and our hope with them? A phrase I've heard repeated a number of times in sermons over the last few years is people don't want to know about what you know. I'll say this a little different here. People won't care about how much you know until they know how much you care. I'm sure you've heard that before. Nobody likes to know it all. And if you are one of these people that says, oh, let me just tell you about the history of this, they don't want to hear it. If they don't think that you care about them, they're really not interested in what you have to say to begin with. So it all starts with understanding this current world. When you get to know people, you usually find a similar pattern of conversation that revolves around hope, believe it or not. This is the time of year that people often focus on hope. You know, people talk about, their hope for, their kids, what they want their kids to do, who they want their kids to marry, happiness, whether they are going to get this house or whether they're going to go on this trip or the things that they want to do in their lives. They have hope in their lives. Life is not wonderful for everybody. Everybody knows that. There's always the haves and the have-nots in the world, and so everyone kind of looks at, hey, I'm in this sort of deficit area, and I know I could have a much better life. And I have hope that that will happen, whether that be with family, whether that be financially, the job, my career. People want to have a better life. And we're no different in this regard. Matthew 5, if you want to turn over to that, to over there in Matthew 5. We're no different in that regard. We have pain and struggles in this life, but we also have hope. We have things that we're working on, things that we're trying to improve. Jobs that we want to grow or obtain. Friendships that we want to nurture. Relationships we want to make as good as they can be. Matthew 5, verses 14 through 16. You are a light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Does somebody see your example in life and say, that person's doing something right? Something I heard at work just this last week that made me feel like maybe I was a little bit on the right track. I work with this guy who's pretty cynical when it comes to religion. And mostly because he had a family member die who was very religious, and he was very upset that as the only member of the household who was religious, she was the first one, it was his mother, who died. And he started thinking, that's enough to make him bitter about religion. And it happens, and you probably know somebody in a similar situation. And so he's one of the people who loves to tease me. He's not anti-religion. He's anti him being a part of religion. And we were talking about some topic this week about just basic goodness in general, and how some people, on one hand, try to be good, and on the other hand, they allow all this sort of horrible stuff to go around. And I can't exactly remember the context about it, but it seemed like the topic we were discussing was, it seemed odd that how could people on one hand want to be good and on the other hand allow such terrible things to go on in their life. And he says to me, well, see, you look at things from a moral perspective. You got to, you know, if you're thinking about these people, morality is not a part of the equation. It was, I remember now, it was certain cultures that have very polite cultures out there. And they're very concerned about their family name. They're very concerned about how they appear in the community. And on the other hand, there's a lot of really terrible things that goes on in that exact same culture. And some of the things were not even fit to talk about here in church. And I think, how could they accept this? And at the same time, they're so concerned about how they appear and your feelings. And they go out of their way. And he says, yeah, well, you're coming at it from a moral perspective. You can't understand this from the eyes of morality. So I thought, okay, well, he at least sees that in our relationship. Do people see the example you have in your life and say, that person's doing it right? To the fact where they might glorify your Father in heaven. So where do we begin? Engaging people with hope. That's the approach that I'm talking about here. They are motivated by hope. A number of years ago, you may remember a sermon I gave called Coping with the Magic of Christmas. And I chose this title because there was something about this holiday that could not simply be explained by just the idea that people wanted a good time and they would do anything for a party. You can't explain away the totality of this holiday with just the fact that everybody wants a good time. Everybody always wants a good time. But this holiday is different. And you say, well, there's a lot of holidays in this world we don't keep. This one is sort of like the Super Bowl of all holidays. And so I was talking about in that time this magic that I called it that exists. Now, this magic is not the type of magic that we would expect to see as miracles. These are the kind of magic we would expect to see a magician have. You know, I believe there's a lot of magic associated with Christmas, but not the kind you see on movies like Miracle on 34th Street, or It's a Wonderful Life, or A Christmas Carol, where there is a divine presence that gets involved at this time of year and wants everybody to resolve all of their issues in life and become a better person. But it's often what people associate with this time of year, that this is the time of year where you can resolve all of the evil and all the bad that's in your life, and they have this extra motivation and desire to actually make a change. The actual magic I refer to is the same type of magic we would see from a very common magician, where you take something that isn't and you convince people that it is. Sleight of hand. And the master magician that does this is Satan himself. And we all know Ephesians 6:12, where it says, "We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts and wickedness in heavenly places." He is the master magician that is responsible for much of what we see at this time of year. It's not about trying to convince people that Christmas is about worshiping the devil. I'm not going there. I'm not trying to make that implication in any way. It's more about the sleight of hand that exists. When you have a magician who takes a coin and makes it disappear in their hands, or they make a rabbit appear out of a hat, or they put you into a box and cut somebody in half, it's all illusions. And they're tricking your mind into getting you to believe something that isn't really there. And Christmas has much of this kind of magic associated with it. They take the fables that are wonderful in principle. You know, who hasn't seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life? Somebody gets a chance to go back and see the impact they've had on the world and realize that maybe they weren't such a bad guy after all. And it makes you feel good at the end. Everybody knows the lesson that was trying to be taught to the people in A Miracle on 34th Street, that, you know, that good people can still be there, and if you just believe, you know, that's the kind of things. And of course they centered around Santa Claus. And they put all this miracle type stuff in these movies where, if only, you know, there's a lot of movies this time of year that they focus on family. And they say, okay, we have this conflict in the family. So-and-so can't get back from so-and-so, or somebody is in some sort of peril. And at this time of year, they do a movie where everything works out at the end and everybody's happy. And they try to focus on what's really important in life, which is family, which is love. And those things are very true. But the magician does the same thing they did with the fact that Christ really wasn't born at this time of year. Just substitute something that is true for something that is not true. It is very true that the most important things in life are love. And if you're going to put your effort into anything, bringing your family together is way more important than buying a new car or going on a vacation somewhere or having some status in life. And so you take these truths and they weave them into the stories of this time of year, and it perpetuates the myth that God really is interested right now to trying to make the world a better place. This is the time of year that God is interested in trying to fix everything. And activities at work and school follow suit, from the decorations to the excitement and anticipation. It's unmistakable. They talk about the get-togethers. They talk about the family that's going to come together. And there's all this anticipation. But there is a master magician at work who has made the world believe in the myth of Christmas, that this is the time of year that God expects everything to improve. That what Christ came to this earth to do, to save this world, has an integral part in this season. And to do that, peace on earth, goodwill toward men, you have to begin to change yourself, and this time of year is the vehicle that God has built around that process. Revelation 12:9 tells us, so the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. If the whole world is deceived, you can hardly find a more appropriate example than this time of year, where everything that's down is up, and everything that's up is down, and everything that's left is right. Of all the deceptions upon humanity, few rival the totality of this holiday, because this holiday was made possible by an earlier deception that happened many, many years ago. We've talked about this, and I will not spend a lot of time on this history section. I only have about a paragraph here to talk about it. But, you know, from the time of the death of Christ until what Christianity pretty much exists today was only a few hundred years. And in that time, in that 200 or 300 years, everything that we know about Christianity changed. Everything. This great sleight of hand happened over this period of time, with the thinking of men like Origen, Hippolytus, Justin Martyr, Augustine, Marcion, and even Martin Luther started the Protestant Reformation. The thinking of these men molded and shaped what Christianity would become, and that was basically that everything that appeared or looked Jewish had to go. That in the first century church, if you weren't in the church, people would probably think you were Jewish. That the Romans, when they evicted the Jews in 49 AD, Emperor Claudius got tired of all the fighting and bickering among the Jews. It wasn't fighting and bickering among the Jews. It was the Christians and the Jews that were fighting one another. The Romans couldn't tell the difference. To them, they're just a bunch of Jews, couldn't get along. And he warned them, and he warned them, and they couldn't get along, so he just threw them all out of Rome. And we know that over time, and you can read about Aquila and Priscilla, and how these were Christians with Greek names who were kicked out of Rome and then were eventually allowed back in. You can read about it in Acts 18, and again in Romans 16, verses 1 through 6. They were kicked out of Rome because of what Emperor Claudius had done, and then a few years later, Claudius had died, and it allowed a lot of people to come back to Rome. And in Romans 16, verses 1 through 6, Paul was actually talking about some of the people that were coming back to Rome. And most of the people he mentioned all had Greek-sounding names. The church in Rome became a very Gentile makeup, and even talks about himself being the apostle to the Gentiles. And so what you see coming out of the beginning was this separating between what was Jewish and what was not Jewish. And the early church fathers wrestled with this. You can do searches on groups like the Apologists and some of the things that they did, mostly trying to convince the Romans that they weren't like the Jews. They didn't want to be persecuted with the Jews, so if you could just see that we're different, then you won't persecute us anymore. And so over those few hundred years, they started saying, you know, if we go to church on the same day, if we worship the same way, if we do the same things that they do, we're always going to be associated with them. And so removing all of those similarities between what Christianity was and what Judaism was allowed for this vacuum. What do? If you're not going to keep the holy days as the Bible tells us to do, what do in its place? And they began to substitute their own days in place. And you can see sort of a pattern that happened when the kingdom in ancient Israel split. When Israel, the 10 tribes in the north, split off from the tribes in the south, they had to differentiate themselves because they were worried that mixing together was going to cause all these problems. So the kingdom in the north built their own temple. They didn't have the authority to build a temple, but they did. They changed the date of the Feast of Tabernacles because they didn't want people traveling together, because maybe if they go down to Jerusalem, they won't come back. And so they changed the rules because it suited them. And that's what Christianity did. And so when you have this idea that you don't have to do what God told you to do, you get this idea that you can pretty much do whatever you want to do. And as long as you do something for a good reason, then God's going to be happy with that. It's pretty much what has made up Christianity today. The rules, the regulations that make up what mainstream Christianity is based upon hundreds and hundreds of years of arguments that were made and justifications that were made that allow a certain way of thinking to prevail. There was a lot of anti-Semites during this period of time. People really began to hate the Jewish people, partially because of the persecution that went on, part of it because they blamed what happened to Christ on the Jews, and part of it because they wanted to not be looked down at the way the Romans did. If you were in Rome and you were a Gentile Christian and you could be in higher society with all the Romans and live a better life in a nicer home in a great neighborhood and not be looked at as those people, there was motivation there. And so adopting some of the Roman holidays, the biggest one being Saturnalia, was a good way in your mind to be looked at in the better families. You know how that is today. People who want to be in the in crowd, they want to be among the people of this world and be thought very highly of. You know, one of the things that Paul talked to them about, if you turn over to Romans 11, the people who were in Rome at the time were mostly Gentile Christians. A lot of these people, I'm sure, were living kind of under the radar. They didn't go out of their way to appear to be of those problem people that were evicted. In Romans 11, starting in verse 13 through 27, "For I speak to you Gentiles inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles. I magnify my ministry, if by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are of my flesh and save some of them." Some of the people in Rome were natural Jewish born people. They weren't there of their own free will. They were slaves. And there were still some there. And they were Jews. And they were slaves because of circumstances, but they had not converted to Christianity. Verse 15, "For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead?" What he's saying here is the Gentiles of this world partially have access to God's truth and God's family and God's way of life because he opened this up, and a lot of the Jews did not accept this calling. But he says here in verse 16, "For if the first fruit is holy, the lump is also holy, and if the root is holy, so are the branches." So what he's saying here is that Israel was God's people. God's people was Israel. And the people of that day were these branches. You know, the Jews were some of these branches. So the Gentiles were some of these branches. They come from God's people, God's holy people, Israel. And he wants them to know that even though that there was this bickering going on between Jews and Gentiles, mostly between Jews and Christians, of which the Gentiles make the largest part of, he wanted them not to get the wrong idea of who the Jews really were. They should not be looked at as their enemy. And he says, "If some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them became a partaker of the root of the fatness of the olive tree, do not boast against the branches. But if you do boast, remember that you do not support the root, but the root supports you." You haven't taken their place. The church is not you. You are a part of them. You have been brought into the root. The root is Israel. Israel is God's people. And as Christianity, you're allowed to be part of God's people. Even though God has broken off some of these branches that would not accept him. So in verse 19, so you say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well said. Because of unbelief, they were broken off. That's why the Jews were broken out of God's people. They were persecuted. They were taken out of the church because they would not accept Christ as their Savior, as the Messiah. Because of unbelief, they were broken off, and you stand by faith. Do not be haughty, but fear. For if God did not spare the natural branches, he may not spare you either. Therefore, consider the goodness and severity of God on those who fell. Severity, but toward you, goodness. And if you continue in his goodness. In other words, God was pretty tough on these people that wouldn't accept him. So don't think that just because you're in here now, that life is great, and you can do whatever you want, and you can fight with them, and you can put them down, and you can just say, you know, the Jews are just terrible, and God rejected them, and now he only cares about us. Because that's not what God is doing. And that we should feel very privileged to be able to be grafted in. God is not uprooting and throwing the plant away and starting again. He's grafting Gentiles, other people, into his original family. Verse 23, and they also, if they do not continue in unbelief, will be grafted in again, for God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut off, if you were cut out of an olive tree, which was wild by nature, and were grafted in contrary to the nature of cultivated olive trees, how much more would these who were naturally branches be grafted into their own olive tree? It's more reasonable to consider somebody who was kicked out of the grace of God, having naturally been brought up in that world, in that culture, in that way of life, to change their way of thinking and come back. Paul saw what was going to eventually happen, is this division between Christianity and Judaism was going to just grow and grow. And in Rome, this was one of the biggest issues because of the intense bickering and fighting that went on between the two. And he was trying to talk to the Christians there and say, don't allow yourself to go down this road where you think yourself better than those who came before you. Because you're wrong if you do. Verse 25, for I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of the mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come, and so that all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion, and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And for this, my covenant with them, when I take away their sins. So he's saying his plan is to rescue Israel from themselves. And not bring them into what Christianity was, but to bring them back into the family, into that holy union with God through the covenant, the new covenant. They broke the old covenant, they were broken off. But they will have a chance to be grafted back into God, partake of the new covenant, just the way the Gentiles were brought into the church and were able to partake in the new covenant. You know, when you look at this and see what Paul is saying to the church, and most historians will admit that the fundamental change of the Christian church came from Rome. It was the Roman churches that immediately was the first ones to adopt this idea of changing Passover to a different day because they didn't like keeping the original calendar, the Hebrew calendar, that you had to be a priest to understand when the calendar started, and if you weren't, then you didn't know when to keep Passover. So they adopted a Roman calendar so they wouldn't be beholden to Jews. And early on, it was the Roman church that sort of led this way. And Paul was appealing to them. Don't go down this road. Don't allow yourself to be cut off from the root of who you are. Do you think Christmas would exist today if people understood you needed to keep the Sabbath and you needed to keep the holy days? Why would somebody keep Christmas if they understand the way that God wants to be worshiped is through the holy day system that he built? That the Sabbath is a microcosm of what he's doing for all mankind. And it's not about being a Jew. It's about understanding God's plan, and the holy days speak to that plan. Today, people try to make Christmas about God's plan. A child is born in Bethlehem. A new king is born there. And so the promise is that, see, God is doing something, and we're talking about the future because Christ is the newborn king. But they worship a baby king. A baby king has no commands, has no edicts, has no example to follow. And so they fill in the example they want. And it's, in large part, a lot of it is trying to be good. And people have a lot of hope at this time of year because they want to be better. You know, when I first came out of college, I worked at this place as an iron worker, a steel fabrication shop. And the person I worked for, I've told this story before, but the person I worked for was this incredibly talented guy in the business. He could take a cutting torch and write his name in cursive through a 1-inch plate of steel. And he just had incredible talent. And he didn't have a lot of patience for people that weren't good. And if you weren't very good at your craft, you needed to work at it. And a lot of times people treated their job like a job. They showed up at 8, they went home at 5, they didn't care. And it was very easy to become on the wrong side of this individual. If he didn't like the work, the quality of work you're doing, he would get right up into your grill. And he was not the most friendly person. He knew all of the playground words. And he didn't hesitate to use them. And he would even, in the middle of yelling at somebody, he would dare them to quit. He didn't want to fire him. He wanted to push them. And he wanted them to excel. But he was a hard person to get to know. A lot of people didn't like him. I generally stayed on the better side of him for whatever reason. I wasn't that talented. I was still learning the craft. But for whatever reason, I was able to stay on the better side of him. And it was probably because of that, that there were times that he would open up to me about things that were important to him that normally he would never talk to anyone about. And one of them was the subject came to his father. His father had died a number of years ago. And he would go down and take care of his mother. She still lived in a part of town that he wished he wouldn't live anymore. Once upon a time, it was probably a good neighborhood in Southern California. But it wasn't anymore. And he wishes she would move out to where he was so he could kind of look after her. But it used to get to him to go down there to see her because his mother was a very religious person. And his father wasn't. His father looked at life as there's a lot of hypocrites in the world, and most of them are Christians. If you weren't a Christian, you were a politician. You know, those were the hypocrites. And he would never go to church. And his mother always went to church. So after his father died, she would say to him, you know, your father's in hell. And that used to just bother him. And knowing that I was a religious person, he shared that with me one time. And he says, you know, I can't go to church. How can I go to church and celebrate the fact that my father's in hell? That does not bother me. My father was a good man, he says. He worked hard. He always provided for the family. He paid his taxes. He was an honest man. He was a good man. He just didn't go to church because everyone there were hypocrites. And I said, you know, I could never worship a God who punished somebody for not being smart enough to find him in the dark. How can you worship a God that way? How can you worship a God who says, hey, I wrote everything in this book. Your job is to go find that book, read it, and do it. And if you don't, you're doomed. He said, that makes sense to him. And I got to share to him, with him, my hope. That this world is not all there is. That we were not put here to live our life however it is. I mean, maybe you're lucky. Maybe you live in a time like we have, a relative peace, and you could choose to go to church, and you could say, okay, you had an opportunity to go to church and you didn't, so I guess you're doomed. But what if you were living in some other time, I said, where you didn't have an opportunity to go to church? What if you were born at a time before Jesus Christ was even born? So how would you even know you were supposed to accept him as your Savior? Where is the fairness in that? And he said, that's right, it isn't fair. I said, so then some other explanation must make sense. What you've been told by your mother can't be all there is, because if it is, it just doesn't make sense. I said, if I'm going to worship a God, he's got to make sense to me. And the God I worship has a plan of returning here and fixing everything that's on this earth. I worship somebody who promises to come back and fix here. I'm not being prepared to go somewhere else forever. He's preparing to come back here and fix where we are right now. The crime in the streets, the loveless families, the abuse that goes on, the wars, the penalty of life. I worship somebody who is going to come back and fix all of that. And the people who never gave church a chance because of whatever reason, doesn't matter what the reason, will be given a chance. He said, that makes sense to him. We have a hope that we can share that doesn't have to be about telling somebody that they're wrong and that they need to do things that are right. Years ago in the church, that was one of the things we would hear all the time. We have the truth, and we have to share the truth. Nobody wants to hear the truth anymore. Everyone has truth, and truth is subjective no matter who you talk to. In politics, in religion, in love, and in war, there's 1,000 truths out there, and everyone is convinced that their truth is right. What they want is for life to get better. What they want is for people to have an opportunity to get out of the pain and suffering in this world. And they would gladly worship God and pray to God if they thought that doing so would correct all the problems in their lives. But, you know, when you work with somebody who says, hey, my mother was a religious person, God didn't save her, so why should I go to church? That's not the time you want to tell them, but she was right to go to church. You just need to do it too. That's not an argument you're going to win. But when you see somebody who has hope and you do something that's going to bolster that hope, if we are going to help others, you're going to have to love them enough and get to know them and learn what makes them tick so that we can start to fill up their bucket with some hope, some real hope. The hope that's around this holiday season is as good as this world can provide. If you tell them that the hope that they have is worthless, what you've told them is they have no hope. So they had a little bit of hope, and you just told them that all the things that they do in this time of year is worthless and wrong. What you've just told them is give up. There's nothing worthwhile. You can't do that. You have to give them something else to replace it with. You have to say, okay, you have this hope that this time of year it'll get better, but then it'll get worse again. How about I replace that with the hope that something is going to happen? Christ is going to return, and he's going to fix everything. How about have hope in that? That you can read in your Bible. Celebrating Christmas, you won't find it in the Bible. But Christ returning to this earth, that's talked about a lot. You know, the fellow I was telling you about, I will say this about him. This is the one time of year that everybody seemed to get along with him. He would work on himself, and he would improve. And everyone said, wow, if it only could be December all year round, we wouldn't get yelled at all the time at work. Because there was, in the minds of many people, the idea that this is the time of year that maybe they could change who they are. And then when the world doesn't get any better and the season is past, yeah, they go back to the way it was. it's almost a depression that naturally sinks in when they realize all the hype and all of what was there has no lasting value. There's just as much crime, if not more so, every single year. Nobody is saying, well, because of this, you know, remember the Christmas of 1984? You know, look how much better the world is. You're not going to point to any one Christmas season and say the world got better at the end of it. If you were to graph it out, the graph is going in a bad direction. And whether you can claim that there was or wasn't a little dip of betterness around the holiday, and there's lots of stories about World War One, the Germans and the French and British set down their arms and they went out and sang songs and played cards and all that for one day out in the battlefield. Yeah, some of those things really did happen. And then afterwards they went back to killing each other again. It didn't make a difference. Titus 3 verse 7. Christianity today talks a lot about eternal life, being saved. Titus 3:7 says that having been justified by his grace, we should become heirs according to the hope of eternal life. Being an heir of eternal life and being brought into a family with more and more people, that is a good and wonderful thing. And the world tries to get people to see that, hey, you can be a part of this too. You can accept Christ. You can become a member of that growing family. But it never makes sense because the world never gets better. And it seems like that if you choose or not to choose religion in this life, you're not going to make a difference. It's basically what it seems like. Christianity is on the decline in most places in the world. And other religions are on the rise. It's like nothing we can do makes a difference because they don't understand God's kingdom. And that it has to get really bad before people will realize. You know, it's like people who get diagnosis with diabetes. And I've known a number of people that got incredibly healthy right after they got the diagnosis of diabetes. Up until that point, they knew that they should exercise more, they should eat better, they should take better care of themselves. But sometimes it's not until you get the diagnosis where you say, wow, I didn't know it got this bad. I have to make a change. The people of this world will not realize that this world is not ever going to get better until it gets bad enough. And we can read about how man will destroy himself if God does not come back to save mankind. And it's no wonder that we've been talking so much about people who have hope in this time of year, whether it's false or not, that there are also people in this world that have no hope, that are depressed at this time of year. And there's a lot of them. I have an article here, I'll just read a paragraph from it's called Why People Get Depressed at Christmas. It was published in Psychology Today back in November of 2010 by author Ray Williams. And he writes, we are told that Christmas for Christians should be the happiest time of the year, an opportunity to be joyful and grateful with family, friends, and colleagues. Yet according to the National Institute of Health, Christmas is the time of year that people experience the high incidence of depression. Hospitals and police forces report high incidences of suicide attempts and suicides. Psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals report a significant increase in patients complaining about depression. And one North American survey reported that 45% of respondents dreaded the festival season. So, if you're surrounded by people that love this time of year, just know that there's at least that many people that don't like this time of year. Because for them, the realization that what hope there is in this holiday never materializes. Maybe the family got together one year, buried whatever hatchets were there, and everybody sat civilly around the table. But then afterwards, the family still was divided. People still felt alone. They were depressed. Maybe the job situation or the problems in their life never got any better. And so they dread this time of year. If you ever want to share hope, if you ever want to think, hey, I've got a light, I should be shining this. Here's a really big audience out there of people that have very little, if any, hope. That you can explain to them that what they're going through is natural because they are part of a dying world. But there is something better coming. That we can give people hope. That we can share with them what we have. You know, the article went on to talk about how people could avoid the doldrums around this time of year by getting out and having a nice walk in the fresh air. That if they would just volunteer at the local food bank or take part in some activity at work, that they could avoid this depression that happens. Those aren't going to work. Because the depression comes from a lack of hope. And if you take somebody's hope away from them, their desire to live goes with it. They know that the world is not getting any better. The wars that are going on around the world and the wars that will come still in the future are something that everyone's come to accept. Crime is not getting any better. Sometimes it seems like we're one riot away from total civil unrest. I was in L.A. when the 1992 riots happened, and I watched the civil unrest come up all around me and the houses and the businesses that were catching on fire. And it was on both sides of the road that I was on, and the road was stopped and no one was moving. And you begin to wonder, when are the hordes of the angry people going to run up there and start smashing cars up on the freeway that weren't moving? Britain last year or recently had civil unrest. It just, people raged against authority, against society. Families are not getting any closer. Divorce rates are climbing, and they're just almost, marriage has been marginalized and almost made fun of to some point where it's just basically a convenience of life that some people try out for a time. We live in a materialistic society, and everything from the time of 9/11, when our leaders get up and tell us that all we got to do to get out of the problems in the country is just go out and spend money. Materialism is not what this country needs. But that's what this holiday for a lot of people is about. They will talk about in the news how life is good or bad based upon how well the numbers at the department store goes. Because if the numbers are good in the department stores, that means the economy is improving, which means you might have a job. So if you don't go spend money you don't have, you might not have a job tomorrow. And this materialism is what is surrounding everyone. You know, we spent a lot of years in the church focusing on the concept of truth. And if we leave out the motivation of love that we should be having with our fellow man, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. If we don't so love the world, we are not going to get them to want to hear what we have to say. They're not going to listen to the hope that we have, and they're not going to believe us that we might know of something that's coming that's really good. We can offer hope, we can offer love, and we can offer answers to their innermost questions in life. How many people in this world can do that? Say, why am I qualified to let my light shine? And why would they see my light over the Christmas lights of this world? If you can answer the questions of the meaning of life and the purpose of human existence, yeah, they'll see that. When they realize that what they're doing in life really isn't getting them anywhere, that maybe what a lot of people do in this world is work for a retirement, when really, when they don't have the work in this world, maybe they can enjoy life a little bit finally. And then when they finally get there and their Social Security isn't enough to live on, or their pensions have been raided and it's not there anymore, they think, what is the point to life? We have the ability to teach them and to share with them the purpose of life. One question the Christmas season can never answer is how God will change this world. the myth around Christmas is that God is trying through this holiday season to change the world, but they never learn how. It's not taught. They say, well, it begins with having this spirit in your heart that makes you a better person. And then they do the movies and the songs and all of the things that make you feel better. And for a time, everyone feels good and say, I have the spirit in me. I'm feeling like a better person. And just like that guy I used to work for, it works for a period of time until the realities catch up with him. And then he realizes it was all false. And he goes right back to where he was. We understand how God will actually change the heart in man. And not just for a short season while the twinkling lights are burning, but for eternity. You may have a desire to hide away until the season is over, but Jesus would never have backed down from an opportunity to reach out and give good news to those he met. Everyone you meet has questions of love, of life, and of happiness that never get answered by a world run by Satan. Everyone you meet needs hope. We have answers. We have hope. And our light comes from God. And if we let that light shine as God intends, then they will see it even among the Christmas lights of this world.